Welcome back to Campbell Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. And today is episode 247 of the podcast, and I'm joining conversation by Joseph Rakic. Joseph has generated over $25 million online and helped over 180,000 people through his fitness coaching app, while his software business, MacroActive, has made more than $100 million in revenue for clients. One of the real OGs of the fitness industry and the online fitness personality space, it was great to interview Joseph when I was in Dubai back in March. Expect to learn how Joseph's life could have been very, very different if he didn't get onto the right path, the accelerators and milestones in his journey to the multi-million dollar businesses that we get to see and talk about now online. Joseph has made some huge decisions to grow his businesses, and we really get into the mindset that he's built to achieve massive success when it comes to the two most important areas to him, and that is wealth and fitness. Today's podcast is sponsored and supported by Factory Weights. Many of you listening will be into your health, into your fitness, into your conditioning. And if you're looking to kit out your home gym or just pick up some basic equipment so you can fit a workout into your busy schedule, then Factory Weights have got you covered. They're a company that I know really, really well, having first started working together in 2020. And it really is of the highest possible quality. I certainly put it through the ringer during the lockdown periods when I used their equipment to keep hold of my physique. And I now have a number of different items across my flat for my prehab, my morning routine, and some of my rehab work as well. Factory Weights have got you covered, whether it's a full gym fit out or whether you're looking to pick up single items like dumbbells, kettlebells, plates, or even resistance bands. The link will be in the show notes for www.factoryweights.co.uk, and you can get 10% off your entire order using the code CALL10 at checkout. This is the final episode from our Dubai tour, and I cannot say thank you enough for the support that you guys have shown to the show in the last couple of months. We are growing at a really positive trajectory, and that cannot keep happening unless you're new here and you hit the subscribe or follow button, or you copy and paste the link to an episode like this one or any of the recent ones that you've enjoyed to a friend, family member, or colleague that you think should join us here in the Cambro cult. We are charging towards episode 250, and I'm really excited what I've got planned for it, but I get to have another brilliant conversation on the way with Mr. Joseph Rakic after the music plays. Joseph, welcome to the show, and I'm here in Dubai making some time. We've got together.
Awesome to be here, and great to have you here in Dubai as well.
Yeah, I'm loving my time so far, but it's been like just so full on. And we were speaking before we hit record about me being from Scotland, you being from New Zealand. You really need to maximize your time in these places where you can make those connections and like go full throttle while you've got the time.
Exactly. So obviously I used to be from New Zealand, and it's hard to, you know, connect with people, collab with people over there. So before I moved here to Dubai, when I would come here to Dubai on like a holiday, 2 weeks, jam-packed everything in that time period, you know, meetings, collabs, filming, you name it. You make the most of it.
Yeah, exactly. And now you live here, you're smashing it, you're doing so, so well. But I want to go back to young Joseph packing orders in a minus 18 degree fridge freezer. What was life like back then?
Yeah, it wasn't good. So I failed school, I dropped out of school. I only went to school basically to see my friends and have my lunch. So obviously I don't have any qualifications. So I went and I was working for my dad. My dad owned a food distributing business where, you know, we'd sell food to restaurants and bakeries and stuff like that. So my job was a packer. So I was working in a negative 18 degrees freezer all day packing food orders. It was the worst thing you could imagine. So yeah, I quickly got out of that. And
what was the vehicle to escape from that? Because there's an element of duty sometimes with a family business to support. And if you've not been academic, it makes sense to get involved in the family business, like support as much as possible. And your dad's giving you a paycheck to try and sort yourself out at that point, really.
I think that's kind of what he wanted, or what he wished, that, you know, I would kind of move my way up in the company and take some charge and take some role. But I was like stupid back then. I had no idea about anything at all. As I said, I failed school. So I was just, you know, looking forward to the weekends, and that was about it.
Yeah.
At that same time, however, I did find my passion for the gym. I enjoyed training. I saw progress in my physique. And that's when I thought, maybe I could do something in regards to the gym. Maybe I'll be a personal trainer. So that is when I went and I studied to be a personal trainer. I got qualified to be a personal trainer, and then I started working as a personal trainer. So moving to the personal training space was my kind of segue out of the freezers.
Yeah, escaping from that
regard.
How quickly did you start to scale in that space? Because again, I was saying before we record, like, you're one of the OGs of the space in terms of not a PT, but an online coach, an online PT, which back then was pretty much unheard of.
Yeah. When I started this online PT thing, I honestly don't think there was anyone else doing it. Like I said before, I don't want to claim that I was the first online trainer. There might have been someone else, but to my knowledge, I believe I was at least one of the first. I was selling meal plans and workout programs on the bodybuilding.com forums before, like, Instagram and Facebook and all that stuff was around. So I think I was definitely one of the OGs for sure. And I kind of got into that space just from posting up my own before and after images from my own results that I got in the gym on bodybuilding.com. People were asking me, hey, what is your workout like? What is your diet like? Can you help me? And so I was helping all these people for free. And then I kind of realized, like, so many people were asking me, maybe I could charge for the service. Set up a basic website. All it had was a buy now button, and they could buy a meal plan or a workout program, and I would write it to them in an email and send that email to them. It wasn't even a PDF. It was literally just they get an email from me with me telling them what to eat and how to train.
Life was a lot more simple then.
Yeah, that was how it was. And at that same time, got my qualifications to become a personal trainer. Gym was my passion, so I wanted to work in the gym. Became a qualified personal trainer, started working in the gym, training clients one-on-one and doing, you know, group classes and boot camps with people as well. But I just knew it wasn't scalable. You're still trading your time for essentially that hour.
A set wage,
yeah. So that is when I knew that online is where I wanted to be. So I started, you know, growing my online business just through the forums. And then Instagram and Facebook and all the stuff came around. As my business started to grow and grow and grow, I then started to work less days at the gym. So I went from like 6 days to five to four to three to two. And then I eventually just went full online and focused on that with my goal to be to grow and scale it as much as possible.
Yeah, it's a process that many guests I've had over the years have spoken about, that whole kind of proof of concept when you're face to face. But it's funny that typically they then start posting online about the results they're getting with their clients, whereas you were so early in the process of this online coaching world that we now have, and people talk about being a little bit saturated, where you were growing online almost at the same time as you were maybe doing some coaching online, because your physique and your transformation was like really striking. And on the forums, someone's like, bro, what's your workout split? Yeah. What do you eat, bro? And it was those really simple days where you were like, oh, this is what I do and this is how it works. And then eventually that's almost like innocently tipped over into a business model where you can be like, oh, well, I should start charging for this advice because I have a level of mastery in it.
Yeah, a level of authority and credibility. And I didn't go out there trying to be that. I just kind of almost fell into my lap, to be honest.
In those days, there wasn't like a roadmap. If somebody looks at your career now, and when we're speaking in 2024, it's really clear to see what you might have to do. And it's very different. It's different platforms. Yeah. And we'll go on to speak about how prolific you are across these modern platforms now. But back then there was no role model to be like, that's how he did it. Let me put my spin on it and try and do it my way.
There was no one, man. And I think one of the first guys that I found out about, it wasn't even an online trainer, but it was just like someone established in the fitness space, obviously Arnold and all that, but it was like Greg Plitt. Greg Plitt was like the first kind of person known in like fitness. I was like, oh, wow. So I started watching his videos on YouTube and getting some inspiration from there.
Yeah, and I've seen photos of you back in the day with like Jeff Sides, Chesbra, because they were maybe that first generation like you who were creating on YouTube when it started to come live. That's probably even before Instagram as well. And like the kind of like the photos at the expos and stuff like that, when those were new to the space too, because previously it was very much, as you said, Arnold, Ronnie Coleman maybe, and these were like the personalities, but it kind of shifted away from like pure bodybuilding to like what I would call like the aesthetics era, where you guys were like really jacked, but you didn't have like the kind of bubble gut, huge physiques that the bodybuilders who got on stage had.
Yeah, no, it was definitely a different era, the aesthetic era. And it was almost like bringing the gym mainstream and making it cool again. Because when the normal public looked at the gym, they just saw these huge bodybuilders and like, oh no. But then like, you know, Ziz and all of that kind of era, they kind of made the gym and looking good kind of like come really.
There was a lot of partying associated with it as well, because you had like Ziz at like festivals, like muzzing and dancing and like really lively. And there was that element of, and this is something I talk about all the time in the podcast, when you get into your health and your fitness, especially as a young guy and you don't have loads going for you, when you master like your physique and you're like, I can control kind of how I look, it leads into confidence in so many 100%. Other areas, and you can maybe go and talk to the girls or other guys are asking you like, oh, wow, like how have you done that? And you're like, whoa, this feels really good. And it's coming from the hard work that I've put in to prove to myself that I am someone that's capable or valuable in this little space.
Yep. Gym and fitness and just achieving something, you know, physical goes hand in hand to so many different areas of your life. Understanding that if I put in hard work and if I stay dedicated and I trust the journey and I just stay committed to this, I'll get results. And once you realize that, you then realize that you can apply that to all other things in your life.
Yeah, it's really encouraging. Like I talk about it quite often as like the pebble at the top of the avalanche towards like a better version of you. And I really think when people be like, oh, what's your advice for young guys in their 20s and their teens? I'm like, get some sort of mastery over your body.
Yep.
And guess what? You can translate it into other spaces too.
100%.
But during that time, I know things weren't as smooth sailing as they might have been. I know you had your brush with the law back in like 2010, 2011. How did that almost derail things in this trajectory that you've gone on to be on?
Yeah, I think everything does happen for a reason, and I definitely learned some valuable lessons then. It definitely made things a lot harder for me. Obviously, I got involved with the wrong crowd of people, started doing some stupid stuff, started selling some illegal things, and then it kind of just backfired, and I guess I got caught up in that fast life, that party lifestyle. You know, young, dumb, stupid.
I think that aesthetics era had a link to the festival scene, though, which of course comes with it, illegal narcotics and the kind of party scene.
Yeah.
And to finance that and to make money, like these things, they kind of go hand in hand, and there's a real risk and a temptation for that easy win. And we know in fitness that delayed gratification is the better path. Yeah. But that's really difficult when you're a young guy and you're maybe exposed to this glamorous lifestyle for the first time.
Yeah, and like, I never tried to get into it to make money, to sell things, to, you know, to sell these drugs to make money. I literally was like at the party or at the club or at the festival, but I knew the guy with the things. And then my group of five mates wanted them. So they're asking me. So I end up getting them. But because I'm getting them, I may as well put some commission on top. And then their friends say, hey, Joseph can get some. So then this guy's asking me for some for all of his group of 10 friends. And then it just had up, I was selling more and more and more, and then there was guys saying, hey, can you get this much? And like, it just,
you get carried away real quick. Yeah. And what I find remarkable about your story, and I watched one of your old YouTube videos, like 10 things you might not know about me, and you were talking about that kind of brush with the law, but things might have been different because you were becoming this fitness superstar online in the early days of fitness superstardom online. And if you can't go to the expos in the US or you can't go and travel and do these meet and greets where there'll be people listening to this that have a photo with you or have seen photos of you from like 2013, 2014, like the proper like glory days of those expos, that what doesn't happen if you do get derailed in the way that you potentially could have?
Yeah, it could have ruined my whole life. And I went through court for a long period of time, more than 2 years, and it kept getting adjourned. And I had to pay more than 250K in lawyer fees and private investigators and everything. That 250K New Zealand, so probably 150K US. And it was bad. And I had to fight so hard to get discharged without conviction, because if I was convicted, then I wouldn't be able to get into the US.
That's what I was seeing in like your post you were speaking about. So for example, you were getting invited to like the Arnold's or the Olympia and you're turning up, and that's amazing for your profile and your reach. And of course, like one of the most important things that drives a lot of people is their impact. If you can't go into those events, then we don't have Joseph Rakic sitting in front of me today, probably in Dubai, smashing it.
Yeah, it would have affected my life so much. So I really fought hard to get that discharge without conviction. And prior to actually me being arrested, I had swear my life, hand on my heart, I'd actually stopped selling drugs for like a year prior to that. But the police had done a big investigation, and they had like obviously a lot of proof that I had been selling in the past. And the reason I did stop was because my fitness business started doing well. And the judge could obviously see that I had stopped. The judge could see that I had turned my life around. The judge could see that I was helping people. And the judge could see that I was trying to make a positive impact and do something with my life. So, you know, I got the discharge without conviction.
It happened
I
still have to for pay a reason.
A fine.
I saw that Salvation Army or something.
Salvation Army. Yeah. I was very lucky to be able to get a discharge without conviction, because obviously some part of my life I did do a lot of wrong. And I guess the main thing, I hurt my parents a lot. They didn't raise me to be a drug dealer, but I just got involved with the wrong kind of people, I guess.
I think it's valuable that you had this other outlet that you could turn your focus to.
Yeah, otherwise I wouldn't have pushed
forward.
If I didn't, like, how can you stop that? You're making so much money. It's hard to stop. I only stopped because I was making so much money from my fitness stuff. And then I was like, wow, I better stop this stuff. So I did. But yeah, it still caught up with me.
Yeah, but I'm glad, like you say, you were able to demonstrate that change of character, that change of direction. And I've read one of the articles from like some small New Zealand newspaper that was talking like Joseph's character changed and he was on this trajectory and this path. And like, we would be pulling him back in to a life of like potential damage if you don't let somebody leave their past behind them.
100%, yeah. It would have really affected me in so many different ways. So
how quickly did the coaching business scale then? Because something that you're known for now is how savvy you are with things like software and technology to have the impact that you want to have. Because when I'm thinking of Joseph typing out emails to clients with their training program and their meal plan, it's not particularly scalable.
No, not at all. So pretty early on, I realized that it was a workload that I couldn't deal with. And then every single person that did sign up with me, that I create a meal plan and workout program, they had access to me via email. So they'd always have these questions. So right away, pretty much early off the bat, I got my best mate, Brett, to come and work for me. He was answering my client emails. So when a client would reply back with questions, Brett would respond as someone from my team. So that allowed me to just focus my time, effort, and energy on creating the plans. Still not scalable. So that is when I knew I needed to scale it somehow. By this time, I had, done a few different business models where instead of sending out an email, I would send out a PDF. And instead of me sending out a different PDF to everyone, I would have maybe 20, 30 different PDFs of all different calorie ranges. I would work out how much calories I need and then send them that PDF. So it was getting a lot faster.
You were building a bank of PDFs. Resources. And
correct. Yeah. So it was getting a lot easier, but still time consuming and not scalable. That is when I went to a web company and I wanted to create an app that can create meal plans and workout programs that are personalized to each and every single client that signs up based on my rules and my beliefs that doesn't involve any manual work. Can you do this? They said they can, and it took years to build 10 times the amount of money that I thought. But eventually we created some software that was essentially my app, and it could create meal plans and workout programs exactly as if I was to manually write it because it was based on my rules. Scaled that, managed to scale GRF through that way. And that is when we thought, wow, maybe we can help other online trainers, because at this point there was other online trainers now, not just me.
The world had progressed.
Yep. But I was like way more advanced than everyone else, because everyone else was still doing the emails and the PDFs. So that is when I thought to turn my app into some software. Well, it was software. We decided to turn that software into a new company. That new company was called MacroActive. And then we decided to help other online trainers do what I do. We would build them a website. We would build them their own app. It would be custom to their clients based on that trainer's rules and beliefs, and would essentially just white label it. We would help them, and then we would take a cut of what they earn. So we've scaled that business. We've got over 700 trainers on our platform and 700,000 end users.
It's wild, isn't it, when you think about... And I think what's helpful is that you knew the pain points as a coach that needed to be addressed by the software, and you'd had proof of concept through building that very software for your own business. And I think there's a stat on your website somewhere about 180,000 people have been through your training plan, something like that as well. There's no way on God's green earth that that would be possible with manual labor or even a huge team. Like you bring on Brett plus 30 hours. You're not doing that. You're not managing those guys. Like, a lot of online coaches tap out at like 50 online clients, because otherwise the service falls off a cliff. But if you have some software in the background doing some of the legwork to personalize and build out plans, that's key. What were some of the big teething problems in terms of getting the app the way you wanted it?
Yep. What wasn't a problem? Everything was a problem. Even things that you don't realize. Like, for example, we make the meal plan, has to have this much calories, this much protein, this much carbs, this much fats, based on what the client submitted. Okay, cool. The client now gets their meal plan. The client gets their meal plan for breakfast, steak and potatoes. Not that it's wrong, but it's just like, no one really wants to have steak and potatoes for breakfast. So like, okay, steak and potatoes can't be for meal one. It can only be me for meal three and meal five. So there's just so many rules like that we had to put into place. Otherwise you get a meal plan with just like weird combinations.
Yeah, mince and oats. Or,
yeah, rice and whey protein.
Yeah, things have just been smashed together because the computer is just thinking that meets these macro requirements, let's go. Whereas we're thinking from a lifestyle and adherence perspective, it needs to be moved around. But these things are only possible when you maybe push it out there and then you're like, oh, that's come back as an issue. Let's go back and test.
Yeah, you'd never know otherwise until you put it out there and then find out, oh, that shouldn't be like that. We need to change that. So many things like that. But you know, trial and error, and you can always make it better. And we've done that over the last however many years we've had it. And now it's very good.
One of my immediate thoughts and like general criticisms that sometimes come up when people think about apps is that, oh, like how personalized can it be? And I'm a big believer that data is power. So the initial questionnaire for a client onboarding, as long as the software is up to handling all this data and all these different options that are available, you can ask unbelievable detail and questions in terms of like pre-existing injuries, exercise they want to avoid, foods they want to avoid. And guess what? That just gets logged into the system and it starts to produce because I think there is an immediate like reticence from somebody to be like, oh, how personalized can it really be? And you're like, well, how much data are you gathering in the first place?
Yep, exactly. And we gather so much data. And then you have to remember each trainer can have different rules and beliefs. So if someone signs up with me, I say each of my clients should have 1 gram of protein per pound of their lean body weight. So if that client's lean body weight is 180 pounds, they'll get 180 grams of protein minimum or more in my meal plan. Another trainer could have a different rule or different belief. If someone's trying to lose weight, month one, they're in a 500 calorie deficit. Month two, 600, then 700, then 800 calorie deficit, and then I cap it there. Another trainer could be less or more aggressive than me, but they set all their rules. So the software creates a meal plan and workout program exactly as if they were to manually do it. It just saves that manual time, and then it allows that trainer to scale to more people and help more people.
And the cost is a big element too, isn't it?
Exactly.
Because you're not paying for someone's time in the same way. So the AI and the software and whatever else, and this is funny that this is artificial intelligence, but before that became a popular term, you were building Macroactive in the past where it was just software. Now somebody's like, oh yeah, I have an AI robot that builds my program. And you're thinking, yeah, it's software.
Yeah.
It is funny, but I really, really think that when you implement things like this, you understand why maybe you can offer a cheaper price point for somebody's entry coaching as well. And something I've learned a lot about through like different educations and mentorships that I've been involved in is effectively somebody's paying for more access. Yep. So if I sign up for an initial training plan and meal plan and it's produced through the software and I'm under the JRF brand, that's great. But then if I want more access to Joseph, I want to be able to like have a check-in, or I want to be able to have access to your WhatsApp, then it's just a scaled offering. Whereas a lot of coaches sometimes just offer the full shebang from the start, and then the price point might be unaffordable for some people to even get involved with you. But maybe if they come in at the bottom end of the funnel, they work with you on that basis. They're like, okay, maybe I want a little bit more. So the higher ticket offer, higher ticket offer, and we work our way up.
Exactly. And even the trainers that do have the high ticket offer, a lot of them don't have a low ticket offer because it's not worth their time. But I'm like, but what about if you had something that didn't take your time? Then all the ones that you don't close on the high ticket, you can sell them on a mid ticket or a low ticket. So I'm just low ticket for my fitness business, but we get 30 clients a day. When we do a promo, we get 50 to 60 clients per day.
Yeah, the numbers are crazy in terms of the scale. It's mad. And in terms of that impact piece, when you talk about Macroactive, 700 coaches, you said?
700 coaches and 700,000 end users.
Crazy, isn't it? Because right there, the coaches are able to scale and impact more people. Yep. And you're effectively just kind of giving them the keys to how they can do that.
Yep, exactly. They're essentially being able to help more people worldwide at a cheaper price point as well. Where if it was done without Macroactive, they're charging a lot more because it's their time, their effort, their energy, and they're helping less people.
Yeah, it is an exciting prospect. And I think when you can use technology and deliver something that the people want, and the market will dictate.
Yep.
The market will dictate whether Sarah, who wants to lose 20 pounds before her wedding, wants an online coach that's on her beck and call all day, every day, and writes this bespoke program and has a FaceTime with her when she's doing her training sessions, or whether they want to enter into a coaching thing where they're getting all this support and all this help, but they have less contact time.
Yeah, and a lot of the clients I work with, they're just a general public. they don't need a coach to tell them to eat exactly this and change their carbs on a day-to-day basis and do weekly check-ins. They just need a basic meal plan and a workout program that they can follow, and then it's updated every month. And because they're just a general public, they're not going to pay $5,000 for a coach. They just want something easy to get them started. So my price point is a very easy entry point for them, and it actually gets them to start.
Yeah, exactly. And the downstream effects from that are they maybe want to work with you on another basis too.
Exactly.
How quickly did things scale then and really excite you on a personal level?
Yeah, they scaled pretty quickly. And when they did scale pretty quickly, I knew I had to do something fast, which was create the software. Once we created the software and it was able for us to take on any number of leads, then I was like, okay, my goal is just to go focus on exposure now, get as many eyeballs as I can, and then provide them as much value as I can, and then you just grow it that way. So it happened pretty fast. Probably within the first couple of years, it started to really scale.
Yeah, and I know you've diversified as well. So there's not just GRF, there's Macroactive. There were supplements for a while as well. Is that still an offering you've got?
Yeah, we still got supplements, but we only sell them on the back end to my clients. Reason being is because if we sell them on the front end, it's harder to sell because there's so much stuff on social media now. And then that call to action is basically a call to action where they could have signed up for my fitness program or something else. The easiest way to sell our supplements is to our clients who have just purchased. They're the warmest they are. They've just paid. They're ready to start the new program. Getting an email to buy supplements makes the most sense. So on the front end, we don't really push the supplements. We just push the GRF training program. They sign up and then they get the supplements.
Keep the goal the goal. Yep. I think too many people get distracted by, oh, we're making a really good margin on these supplements. Let's start selling more of them. Okay, great, but why don't I get a customer that's going to be sticky and work with me across various different bases as well? Because you even had like a clothing line as well for a little bit.
We had a clothing line. We don't have that anymore. But again, it was the same thing.
It's a tough market.
Just to sell it, it is. Just to sell that to our existing clients. But yeah, the supplements seem to work the best.
One of the things that I found out when I was researching for this is that you bought one of the most desired fitness domains possible.
Yeah.
And that was IFIM.com.
Yeah,
so if it fits your macros, yeah. Which exploded probably like 2016 onwards.
Yeah, yeah.
And like how many people are you getting access to through something like that?
Yep, so we bought IIFYM.com because it was getting 6,500 unique views per day. I think it was per day or per week, to that website. People looking for a meal plan. It was a no-brainer. So we just plugged it into Macroactive, we automated the system, and then we did some high-ticket stuff on the back end.
Because if I think about...
We've sold that now, though, however.
Interesting, yep. But you had your fun with it, and yeah. it went well. Because yep. If I think about the period when you were coming up, clean eating was like a big thing, and it was a very bodybuilding-style diet. And then you had this period where people went a bit mad, and you had all sorts of junk to fit in within your macros, and like people were having like... oat bowls with like loads of random stuff on the top, or like smashing a full pizza at the end of the day, or whatever that whatever it was to like hit their macros perfectly. Exactly. But it makes total sense that you would have a meal plan or a coaching based offer off the back of somewhere where somebody's going for information, and you can say, yes, you can have the free information here for the macro calculator, whatever it was on that website, if I remember it. But it then leads into, and if you're willing to pay this amount for entry level product, guess what? We'll do it for you.
Yeah. Exactly. So it worked out perfectly because they land on that website, they fill up the calculator because they want to find out what their macros are, how much protein, carbs, fats, and calories they need. They fill it out, but when they fill it out, we get their email, their number, all this. They filled it out, they see how much calories they need. Okay, I need 2,300 calories. How do I do that? So then the next page is selling them on the meal plan based on 2,300 calories. And if they don't buy it then and there, hey, we've got the email, we've got their number. We've got a dialer to call them. They go through our email sequence.
How quickly were you building out a team to do that kind of back end stuff?
So a lot of that team that worked on that was our team from Macroactive. So we kind of crossed the businesses a little bit. And we had a pretty big team at Macroactive. We had about 150 plus staff.
Wow.
Yeah. So so we moved some of the staff to just handle the IIFYM.com business.
Yeah, it's really cool because I think if people want to join the dots between GRF scaling, you becoming this kind of online phenomenon all the way through to having these multiple businesses and building teams, what are some of the lessons along the way that you think would be valuable for people when it comes to building out staff and managing teams?
Hire people better and smarter than yourself. So I've pretty much done that for all of my business decisions that I made, I guess, it was always hire someone better and smarter than myself. So obviously I didn't know how to run a business like a business. So I got a manager. I don't know how to edit videos. I got no idea. So I get someone better and smarter than me. Got a video guy. And I pretty much just do that with everything. So you build a team that is essentially a team of people that are better and smarter than you, and they're going to help you take your business to the next level. Now my team is pretty big, so it's other people in my team hiring the new people, so it's not me anymore. Again, better people to do the job than myself.
Yeah,
amazing. And it's just delegating it to someone better than yourself.
How do you recognize what your own skill set was versus who you might need to come and help you?
Well, I knew pretty early on that my skill set was kind of like front-end marketing exposure, but I knew that I didn't know how to do an email. I didn't know how to do an email sequence. So I had no idea about email marketing, but I knew email marketing was good. So I'm like, should I learn email marketing? No, just find someone that knows how to do it and get them to do it. And that to me made the most sense. So I could focus all my time, effort, energy, what I know best, creating content, getting exposure on the front end. I don't know how to run ads. Should I learn or should I just get someone better than me? Or just get someone better than me and just put all those people in place?
Because it would take time away from you doing the thing that...
What I'm best at.
People talk about the podcast in the last year became ranked in the top 1% globally. Really cool, wow. Right?
Yep.
But if you look at your business, you're probably in the top 1% of fitness businesses. You've probably got one of the top 1% physiques in the world as well, if you look at the different people that you can compare to. You're probably a top 1% content creator. So why would you go from having these three assets to, oh, I'm going to become one of the top 50% email copywriters? Why don't I just go and find a guy that's in the top 1% of copywriting? Mm-hmm. And guess what? We make this deadly duo. And then I've got the ads guy who's one of the best in the game at that as well. Yep. Let's all combine. And if you're adding these component parts to a business, they're going to be a lot more deadly than if you are like fairly average at one or two of those things. And you're taking time away from these skill sets where you are like one of the leaders.
That's another point. It's not just doing those other things. It's taking that time away from where you are good. So you're getting less return on the stuff that you're good at.
Yeah. And if I look at how you show up on social media, the term I would use is relentless. Mm-hmm. How do you get so much done?
Yeah. I post on every platform every single day, sometimes multiple times per day. Sometimes I won't put in my story and I purposely do that to let my story die. It's the hardest thing for me to do. So when someone tells me they can't get stuff to post, I'm like, man, I struggle to let my story die for 24 hours. It's like hard. I'm like, I just need to put something up. My content strategy is good because I have no strategy. And that's what works for me. I don't have a schedule. I don't have a post time. I don't have any rules. I don't say I'm going to post this at that. I don't plan anything. All I do is create content, create as much content and bank it. So I've got a bank, like a favorites folder on my phone, where I've got so many videos and so many pictures that I've never posted anywhere. After this podcast, I might decide to put something up. Maybe tonight when I'm in bed, like 11:30, I might decide. Just whenever I feel like it, I post up. My marketing manager got me to do a schedule for a time. I did it for about 3 days. I was like, no, that's not me. Because I had to post at 8 p.m. New Zealand time, but I was out for dinner. So I'm at dinner and I'm like, oh, like, hold up, guys. I'm just...
It pulls you out the present moment as well.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, no, I don't like a schedule. I don't need a schedule to get it done. I get it done regardless. Maybe a schedule might help someone. But for me, I just enjoy doing what I want when I want. And that's what I find to be most effective.
I think recognizing how you're wired is something that, across the 4 years in the podcast, I've recognized in my successful guests, they understand how they work and they lean into it. Somebody might say to you, oh, Joseph, that sounds disorganized. And you're like, well, look at my content output. Whereas somebody might be like, oh, that terrifies me, the thought of not knowing what Tuesday's post is, not knowing what Wednesday's post is, because then I might not find time to do it. Whereas I think, and this is a term that comes up a lot as well, the tools will be heavy, but they'll feel light in your hands. So you're somebody that finds it easy to create.
Yep.
You love filming videos, you love taking photos, you're doing things interesting in your day-to-day life that you straight away are thinking, oh, that's a post.
Yeah.
Cool, that's a story, that's a tweet, that's a Snapchat, that's a TikTok. These are relatively easy for you. What's not easy for you is if you were told like, oh, you need to create this type of content for next Wednesday, and you're thinking, why don't I just create what I really want to that I think will serve my audience? And at this point in the game, you probably know what's going to hit the mark.
Yep, exactly. And hey, even if posting at this time on this day might give me a little bit more reach, I still won't do it. I'll just do it whenever I want to, regardless of that, because if I follow a structure, it then becomes like work to me and it becomes like a chore. And if I don't like it and I don't enjoy it, I'm not going to do as well. I love and enjoy what I do, and just, I might be having breakfast and then decide to put something up. I love that. I don't like rules, and I don't like restrictions, and I don't like being told what to do. So I just do it as I wish.
Yeah. And where do the ideas keep coming from at this stage of the game? Because you've been here for such a long time. You've got so much expertise, and I guess it makes it easy in some ways, but in other ways, do you ever feel like it's running dry?
Yeah. Sometimes it is hard to get content because you feel like you've done pretty much everything. But you know, I get ideas from Instagram and TikTok, and I see things. I'm like, oh, this is a good style of video. I might do something like this. My bank that I have is big. Like, there's probably 100, 150 videos and pictures in there now that I haven't posted. So I don't set days to go and film. But maybe one day, if I decide to film, I'll get a bunch of content. And when I do get this bunch of content, I've got the ideas in my head of what I want to get and create. But yeah, I think just being on social media yourself, seeing what is working, seeing what's not working, and then trying to go in that direction, but not copy the style exactly.
Let's put your own stamp on it. Don't be the, to use the UK, like the Aldi or the knockoff version, the BTEC version of somebody else that you see. But if somebody does a particular style workout video and you're like, oh, that's really good. Or somebody does like and I've seen some of your like kind of more humorous TikToks, stuff like that as well with like your wife or with somebody else. And you're like, okay, I like, put your spin on it. Yeah. Don't like copy or imitate.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I think if you do that and you be unique and you be yourself, people are going to enjoy it and they're going to follow you.
Yeah. And the industry is always moving. And I think as we've spoken about, you can definitely put your hand up as one of the most established coaches in the spaces. Is there anything you still feel like you're learning about from that perspective?
Oh, I learn every day. You learn every day, just new things that you don't even realize that you're learning until you're like, oh yeah, that is true. Like even like, we always used to create this long format content, and then it started getting less and less and less and less and less views. And then you didn't realize until one day, I was like, oh, people's attention spans are screwed now. Let's focus on short format. Like just little things like that, you just learn every single day. So I don't think you'll ever know everything. You'll always learn. And I think that's the beauty of it. We're all a sponge. And the more we can learn and then apply, the better we'll get.
I think there's an element though, because you are so experienced, you could shut yourself off and be like, I've been there, I've done it, I've made it, and not be open to that.
Yeah, yep, definitely. But the person that thinks he knows everything never ends up working out for him. So I think you can learn from anyone and everyone. And we know short format content works. People's attention spans are terrible. But then you have to think outside the box and look at guys like Sam Sulek, you know, the YouTuber.
Yeah.
By the book,
it shouldn't work.
It shouldn't work. He's not cutting his videos. He's not doing any snippets. He's not doing any clickbait thumbnails. He's not doing any clickbait titles. But he is one of the most engaged people I've ever seen online, and he's growing faster than anyone I've seen online. It's completely out of the box. He's real. He's raw. He's consistent. And I think people like that. And I think people are going back to somewhat long format. And what he's done is absolutely amazing, even though it goes against everything in the book.
Yeah.
But you can't fault him for it because he's done better than anyone else.
I see that. And then last time I was out in Dubai, I interviewed Daniel Priestley. And he's a really wise entrepreneurial guy. And he spoke about the pendulum always swings back. And I think the pendulum had swung to super highly polished, limbic hijacking, thumbnails and titles. And the audience was a little bit sick of it.
Yeah.
So Sam's at the other extreme of that. And he's like, I'm not going to mess around in terms of like try and trick you into watching a video that's not what it's about. It's going to be like back workout. And guess what? I trained back and I chatted to you in my car afterwards about how the session went and what I'm going to eat. And we were like, okay, give me that.
Yeah.
Because I'm sick of this highly cut up, fast paced montage of a back workout that... That isn't satisfying me in the way that it used to.
Yeah.
So let's check out. So the pendulum's kind of swimming back, and I think we'll end up in some sort of equilibrium where we're kind of like, it's well produced, but it's not as high end as it was, and it's not like got a million different jump cuts to keep our attention.
And even the way he films is just, him there being himself. Like, I'm even a culprit of this. Like, when you're filming content, let's just say I filmed a bicep workout, I'll be like, high energy, three bicep, I don't know, three things that you shouldn't be doing when training biceps. Like, you're trying to, like, shock them. Ugh. And people are just sick of that shit now. They just want to see someone just be a Sam.
Yeah.
It's actually good and refreshing. It's going back to that.
I think it's good because, like, given how long you've created over, there's going to be periods where it's swung back and forth and it's changed in between, and your content has to adjust to meet the demands of the market.
Yeah.
Otherwise, does. You won't get seen.
Yeah. I think actually, you know Rich Piana?
Yeah.
He did a pretty similar style to Sam Sulek, actually. It was like the long videos.
Him, I mean, I really hope that Sam's looking after his health better than Rich was. Jeez.
Exactly. But yeah, very interesting. It's a good thing. I even saw a tweet from Mr. Beast saying that he's going to long format content now, and it seems to be working a little bit better. I was like, oh.
Be interesting.
He's like the king of views.
Exactly, because what the guys at the top do change things, but because this guy's coming up, you have to pay attention.
Yeah.
And you have to take note, and you have to recognize how's that working.
Yeah.
And then put the GRF style of Sam Sulek, not like a budget Sam Sulek. You don't want to do the same thing. Yeah, it's so interesting. But I use the term relentless for the amount of, like, effort you put in. And there's a clip of you going around where you're talking about, I'm always working.
Yeah.
I love working. Why is that?
I don't know. It makes me feel fulfilled. It gives me purpose. If I'm not working, like, I don't know what to do with myself. I've got no hobbies apart from the gym. If I'm not eating, sleeping at the gym or with my wife, I'm literally working. I don't play games. I don't watch Netflix unless it's with my wife. Any spare time I get, I would rather just be working. And I wake up early in the morning. I couldn't think of anything worse than just sitting there and watching a movie or playing a game. Like, I just got to get straight to it and straight to my work. And I've got so many messages, so many notifications, so many emails, so many Slack chats. And if I don't get through them, is it anxiety? I don't know. Is it anxious? I don't know. I just feel like I have to get it done so I feel good. And I want to feel good, so I just execute. The people always say, oh, like, it's your birthday today, or you're on holiday, you better take some time off. And I'm like, why would I ruin my birthday by taking the day off? Like, I love what I do. People can't understand that I love what I do. Like, if I'm on holiday, they think, like, I want to take time off. I'm like, no, like, it would make my holiday terrible. Like, I love working. Work makes me feel good. So if I can just nail out some work in the morning, I feel so good inside, and the rest of my day is good. If I'm not working and executing, I feel like I'm going backwards maybe. So I don't feel good. So yeah.
I think it's important people recognize that we're not all the same.
Yeah.
And you'll have people online that maybe want you to be more balanced. And I saw the comments on your post, and I saw the comments on a very similar post from Hermosi where people were, like, slating him.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, if you walked a mile in either of your shoes, you'd understand that it's coming from a good place. Because as you say, on your birthday, if you got told to take some time off, you'd be like, I wouldn't enjoy that.
Yeah.
Whereas somebody else is like, that's their idea of, like, oh, my birthday, put my feet up, chill out a little bit, play on TikTok and not post. I'm just consuming today. Whereas you're like, I'm creating. I'm still going. Yeah,
exactly. And it's because they look at it from their shoes. They think, oh, I hate my work. Like, so they assume that I must hate my work. They can't understand that I love what I do. So when I say I don't want to take time off, they can't understand it or comprehend it, because they associate work as, you can't like that. But I love work. I swear my life, you give me $1 billion today, you give me 10 billion, you give me $1 trillion today, I swear my life, I will still work every single day of my life without fail. Swear to God.
Because it gives you that feeling you're chasing.
Yes. Why does Elon Musk still work? He could retire and sit on a beach all day. It's because he has a passion and a burning desire inside of him that he needs to just hustle and move forward and get things done and change the world. It's why he still works.
Yeah, it's interesting you use the word burning. I recently interviewed a tech entrepreneur in the US called Adam Rossi, and Adam spoke about selling his company for $100 million. Him and his wife, they built it from nothing when they left university, scaled it all the way up, like, during the 90s and the 2000s when tech was a lot less popular. And he was like, the biggest thing people need to realize when they exit a company is that you must fear every day is Saturday syndrome, because that is his worst nightmare. Mm. And he was like, if you're the kind of person that builds something from zero to 100 million, or use whatever figure you want, right? you're not the kind of person that's going to want to play golf every day, go to the coffee shop and sit around and talk about what's happening in the news or the media. You want to be building, or you're going to be destroying something else. You're going to lean into another vice like alcohol, drink, like drugs, sorry, whatever will tempt you and give you something else. And he was like, beware every day is Saturday syndrome. And a lot of the listeners that listen to this are in the building phase. And some people are thinking like, oh, when I get to this, I'll exit and I'll be happy. Or when I get to this amount, I'll ease off the tools and I'll ease off the accelerator and I'll be happy. You're probably not going to be happy if you get to a particular point. You're going to want to keep going.
Exactly. And when you say that, it just made me actually think, I think there's like less than 2,000 billionaires in the world. I would love to know how many of them have retired. A high majority, I would say, are still hustling because it's in their blood.
Yeah, we can't stop.
They can't stop. I would love to know that statistic. How many billionaires are actually retired?
Given how hard you work, is there something that you're still proving to yourself on a daily basis?
Just showing up and getting it done and executing. Like if I'm not doing that, I feel like I'm not being my best self. So I'm not being who I could be.
I think the story we tell ourselves is really important. So for example, my identity is somebody that is the man that I said I was going to be. Yep. I do the things that I said I was going to do. And that the only time that I'm not really pleased with myself is when there's a delta or a gap between my expectations and my reality. Now my expectations shouldn't always be like fiscal things or metrics, but they should be like effort or the input that I put in, not just the output.
Yep.
So if, for example, you had notifications left at the end of the day or like Slack message unreplied, okay, that's not great. But as long as you were like, well, actually I was working really hard and I put in the effort to try and get through as many as I can and deliver on a quality basis, then your expectations are, I largely worked in line with who I said it was.
Yep.
Whereas if you decided to throw your phone away, throw your laptop away and go to the beach for 3 hours and it didn't feel good in a way that you wanted it to, that's when like that kind of harsh self-critic can creep in.
Yep, 100%. You feel good by the effort you put in. Same with the gym. If I go to the gym and I train arms but I fluff around, I don't feel good. But if I go to the gym and I smash my arms, I walk out of there like, wow, that was so good. You just felt good.
Yeah. I wrote down a quote before coming in. It's from Jeff Bezos, and it's about 20 years ago he said this. Stress doesn't come from hard work. Stress comes primarily from not taking action over something you have some control over.
Yeah.
Think about that. You've got control over the effort you can put in, and you know there are these things in your to-do list that have to happen, and if you choose not to do them or you're unable to do them, that's when the stress creeps in, the anxiety creeps in, and you feel less like yourself.
Yes, yeah, you're so right. That's so true. I like that quote.
I love these things because some of the wisest minds on the planet now, we get access to what they've said.
Yeah.
And you can be like, okay, well, let me put that into 31-year-old Colin from Scotland's shoes and find out how it fits and what it means. And then I'll ask Joseph about it and he can figure out how that sits for him as well. But it's been interesting to watch the trajectory you've been on because you don't just talk about fitness now, you obviously talk about business as well, and you've got your community as well from like a wealth perspective, and you're encouraging people to do that. And I wonder, how have you struck the balance between focusing on things like growing your businesses and actually enjoying some of the fruits of your labor too, like maybe material desires you've got, or maybe purchases that you felt, I really need to make that?
Yep. They all tie in. Buying my car, even though you might say it's materialistic, it's still part of my business. It's social proof. It's credibility. Yes, I did somewhat okay with my fitness business. I don't give myself a big head. And I made a lot of money doing it. I wouldn't be able to start a business coaching or a business mentorship if I didn't have the social proof, if I didn't have the car, if I didn't have the watch, if I didn't have all this stuff. I wouldn't have the credibility to be able to get anyone to take me serious. So even though they are materialistic things that I bought, it is part of my business and part of my image, which is, what is the Jay-Z quote? I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. Yeah, it's essentially the same thing.
It makes sense, doesn't
it? Yeah.
Like you have to have credibility. And if those material desires are sitting there and there's an itch that needs to be scratched, I really rail and push back against the people that are like, oh, you shouldn't ever want more. You shouldn't ever want the nice thing. Like that's materialistic. That's surface level, and you're thinking, well, there's a reason these things are bought by so many people. Mm-hmm. And yes, we hedonically adapt because the car that you had 10 years ago, it'll be a nicer one now. And the watch you've got now, you might end up being like, okay, I really want to this watch as well, because that's just how we're wired. Yeah. But satisfying yourself for those periods of time and maybe having something you've worked towards and you feel the connection to making that purchase shouldn't be something that's like told off.
I know. And I don't know why it is. It's people always denounce money for some reason. But you know, it can be good from so many ways. And like, if you achieve something and you go and buy something, even though it's materialistic, you feel so good when you've got that. And it just gives you so much more motivation. That motivation goes back into your business, which helps you grow and scale even more. And if you have a good business, you're helping a lot of people. It's a positive feedback loop. And I don't know why so many people look at this in a negative way.
I think it's a little bit of inferiority sometimes. So you can sometimes shine a light on somebody's inadequacies by what you're achieving. And don't get me wrong, like, I am not massively materialistic. There's been a few purchases I've made that have made me really pleased, but I'm not massively driven. Like, so for example, I've seen your car, it looks amazing, but I'm not like, oh my God, I need to get a Lambo or a G-Wagon. Yep. Like, it's not driving me. At some point, maybe I will. We'll find out.
Yep.
But I'm not like chasing it down. I'm not heavily influenced by what I see. But I think some people see these things and they're like, oh God, I wish I had that. And they feel like a level of anger towards the person that's got it.
Yeah. So the way for them to try and make it okay for themselves, they try and bring it down in a negative way, which doesn't really work because, you know, there's a great quote from, I think, Gary Vee. If you're trying to be the biggest building in the city, you want to build the biggest building in the city, not tear every other building down. And I think that's how so many people look at things. They just know they can't be this, so they try and tear everyone down. I'm like, it doesn't work that way, man. Just focus on yourself and getting yourself better.
Absolutely. And you're here in Dubai and you are incredibly successful, but there's going to be sheikhs that you could stand next to and you'd feel like a pauper. You'd be like, oh man, I'm a brokey. Because these guys are just wealth off the radar, and that's cool. But if you then use that as your metric as the tallest building you want it to be, oh, you would feel terrible. So let's not use that. And like in the podcast space, there's loads of podcasters I look up to. I don't get jealous of their downloads or their plays or their sponsorships or their deals. I'm just like, I'm having a great time. And if I have conversations like this on a weekly basis, I'm really enjoying it. And I know there's a ripple positive effect for my audience. And if I listen to someone who's absolutely smashing it in the game, like I really look up to Chris Williamson, who's been a big supporter of my show. He's one of my first ever guests. I look at how Chris's question style, I look at the studio setups he's got, and I'm inspired. I'm not offended or angry about where he's going. I'm like, wow, a rising tide is raising all the ships, and I'm one of the ships that's on the way up because I'm inspired by what he's doing.
They operate from a scarcity mindset, and it's just a negative mindset. Like, I know a few billionaires now, and man, they inspire me. I got another mate that I know, 100K a day, not a week, not a month, not a year, 100K a day he does. I'm like, what? Like, that inspires me. I don't get a negative vibe. I don't get jealous or anything. I'm like, man, it just opens up the belief in my head that numbers like that are possible. And then it makes you just climb that ladder more.
Yeah,
I don't know why people attach a negative to it. It only holds themselves back.
Do you remember Johnny Starr? He was in that kind of Z's Chessboro crowd.
Oh, yes, I do. Yep,
Australian guy, incredible physique. Mm-hmm. Johnny was on the podcast a couple of years ago. And when he was coming up in Australia, he was one of the first Gymshark athletes.
Yep.
Like, he was in that kind of famous video with Jeff Side in that gym in Birmingham where they're in the Lux tracksuit and stuff
like
that.
Yep, I know the exact one, yep.
And he got such a hard time back home because he claimed natural for a little bit, he wasn't, and he was getting so much heat for it and he didn't really know how to deal with it at that point. Yep. He kind of went off the radar and stopped. And he was talking about it being tall poppy syndrome.
Yes, 100%.
He was the tall poppy in the field and the other poppies wanted to cut him down. Get down from up there. We don't like you up there. We want you down here with us in amongst the mud and the soil. And I really relate to that because I see when somebody tries to do something different, it can sometimes be shat on or pulled down or harassed. And I think there's a temptation when somebody sees like, and a rude term would be like a flash lifestyle, but maybe an aspirational lifestyle would be a nicer term to use. They can be like, oh no, I don't like what that guy's about.
Yeah, crabs in a bucket. It's that mentality. But the only thing they need to understand is that mindset and that mentality is only affecting them. Like, bro, you're not helping yourself. You're only affecting yourself by acting that way.
You have a community now that's really aspirational and your wealth network. Mm-hmm. Yep. How important do you think that is for young men and maybe aspirational young women as well to have that around them?
Oh, it's so important. Your network becomes your net worth. And if you can surround yourself with other people that are winning, it just gives you so much more motivation and so much more energy to win as well. They say you become like your five friends that you hang around. And if you hang around guys that just talk about other people in a negative way, I don't know, smoke and drink and play video games and do nothing with your life, you're going to end up like that. But if you surround yourself with winners and people making lots of money and achieving great success in life and helping so many people, by default, you just end up doing the same because your energy just matches theirs. And I think too many people just try and bring other people down instead of just kind of working with them and attaching yourself to that circle and that group.
Yeah, and one of the things you've been talking about in your community a lot is crypto.
Yep.
And at the time of recording, I think we're about to hit another all-time high for Bitcoin as it's done about 6% overnight, and I think we're heading that way. And not to timestamp this episode too much, but hopefully we're heading towards that. When did you get interested in that space?
I got interested a long time ago. But, you know, I bought early and I sold, and I bought early and I sold. Done that many times, but I now just understand the future of crypto and of Bitcoin especially, and I'm a big believer in Bitcoin and Ethereum, so those are the main things that I kind of hold, but I also have a lot of fun with the other coins here and there.
You play with some of the altcoins.
Yep. Now, I don't really advise or recommend it because most people will get wrecked, especially with the meme coins. I don't like meme coins because they're shit coins and at the end of the day, they're just pointless. No use case, but you can make a lot of money in it because of community. So if you do want to play around, just be 100% aware that you can lose everything. high risk, high reward. But, you know, I think if you do want to get into crypto, Bitcoin and ETH is the safest. Just dollar cost average every week or every month. Just invest some amount and treat it as a savings account. Hold it for 5-10 years, you should be okay. Not financial advice.
Yeah, but well, everyone, as of today, will be profitable. Bought Bitcoin, it's profitable.
Yeah, unless they sold it.
Yeah, exactly. Unless you got shaken out when it got a bit frightening, which it did. Yeah. Like, I bought in 2020, like late 2020. So I was up, mm-hmm. and then end of 2021, it's kind of just been in a bear market.
Yeah.
And then it's been up. And I was averaging in during the bad period because I managed to have good counsel around me. I've had a lot of episodes on the podcast with guys that are really clued up in the space. Yep. So the audience were reassured that even though everyone's telling you Bitcoin's trash right now, you need to understand that when it comes back round, it's going to be the same people who are like, how does this Bitcoin thing work? And I see it's had a new all-time high. Like, like, how do I buy some? Like, what exchange do I use? Or what wallet do I use? Or like, why are the fees higher on this one than this one? And you're thinking, well, if you were interested when we were like most resolute and able to stand up to the pressure, you would probably be profitable by now.
Most people end up losing money. Let's just talk about Bitcoin, for example, because they only buy it based on the price. They see the price going up and up and up and up and like, oh, what is this? Should I get in? So they buy it at the peak. But they're not buying it because of what Bitcoin is. They don't do the research. They don't understand it. So like, you need to buy the thing for the thing, not based on the price. So my best advice to anyone watching this is just go watch some Michael Saylor on YouTube, do 50 hours worth of homework on that, and then you'll understand the value of Bitcoin and why it is such a great asset to hold for the future. And then, even if you do own a lot of Bitcoin, you want the price to drop because you can buy more at a discount. So I have a lot of Bitcoin, not a lot, but like I got a decent amount.
You're accumulating.
So when Bitcoin's going up, I'm still not happy because I buy every month. So I'm like, damn, now next time I buy it, it's going to be, I'm paying more. Because I know in 10 years, I know in 15 years, 20 years, it's going to be a lot. So right now, I want the price to come down as much as possible because I'm buying every month and I'd rather buy cheaper.
There's always a new bottom as well. I think that's one of the most interesting things I've noticed because I got involved in the space in 2020. The bottom was like 6K in March 2020 at the start of the lockdown. But then the bottom this time around after that cycle was like 17K, 16K.
Yeah, 16, I think.
So that's up. Yeah. That's pretty interesting. Yeah. The bottom next time round in the cycle, because it will correct again. Yep. We all understand that. There's people that are like moon boys and want to promote it and tell you it's going to go to whatever in a straight line.
I hope it comes down.
But it's not how the market works. It's not how the market works. Like even with ETFs and in institutional money in there, There's still, there, yeah. It's mathematics. It's, yeah. Bitcoin's programmed. It's going to come back down, but the new bottom might be 30.
Yeah,
be
32. Exactly.
So you're never going to get it for the bottom you got it at previously. So you need to like take that into account. And I think the smoothing effect that you're talking about with your dollar cost averaging is a very reassuring tactic, but it's still hard because sometimes you're like, oh, it's gone down. Like maybe this is the, maybe it's going to zero. You get shaken out.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot of, like, I've got a lot of mates and they've got like, maybe like $5,000 in Bitcoin. And even when the price was going down, they're like, oh shit, the price is going down. I'm like, bro, you've got $5,000 in there. You should want the price to go down so you can buy more. Like, what do you want to make? $5,000? Like they're just so small-minded.
You're focusing in the short term.
They're focusing on the short term. And I'm like, bro, meme coins are for the short term.
Do you find that's like a level of excitement for you to get involved with?
What, the meme coins?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a bit of thrill, you know? I made 94K USD in like, I think, 5 days, 6 days on Ping, the meme coin. Just stupid stuff like that can happen.
I see you as an investor, not a trader. But yeah, that's what you would call like selling at the right time rather than trading.
I buy and sell. I don't trade. I do trade though, but like I don't post. Like I'm in a trading group where I just copy signals. Mm. But I don't know anything about trading. Like I'm not a trader. I don't make my money trading. All the crypto stuff that I post on my stories and everything, it's not trading. It's me buying or investing and then holding and then selling.
When it hits a target,
yeah,
Joseph's out, or he's pulling his profit out at least. Yeah. Maybe the state can write it out, whatever else as well. I think that's like a valuable lesson for people because a lot of people sometimes look at guys doing well in crypto and they think they need to be on the charts all day, every day.
Yeah.
But the market sentiment will probably dictate that you should probably log on and check what's happening because everyone's talking about it. Because like we'll be on our phones after this tonight and everyone will be talking about it because Bitcoin's potentially going to go 73, 74, 75. Let's find out and see. But guess what? We've been plugged in for long enough that we know what that means in the greater scheme of things.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's exciting. In terms of that material desire piece, you mentioned your car. I know you've like had like a pet monkey as well.
Yep.
What else has been like an itch that you needed to scratch in terms of like Joseph wants to buy this and experience this?
The monkey was definitely a big tick off my to-do list. I wanted a monkey since I was a kid, man. What else? Honestly, nothing else that I can really think of. I think everything that I've wanted, I've kind of got and done.
You've ticked those boxes.
Yeah.
I guess my-
Hey, like I would, yeah, there's definitely other stuff like, hey, maybe one day a private jet, stuff like that, that I don't have yet. But for now, there's nothing that I don't have that I really want.
One of my final questions then would be, what would success look like by the time you turn 40?
I think success is just happiness. Honestly, it is happiness. And that is different for everyone. Like for me, success, what is happiness to me is making a lot of money and living the life that I want to live. But I think if someone isn't making millions of dollars, but let's just say they're making 5 to 10K a month, and they're working from their laptop and they're in Bali and they're in Thailand and that's what they love, that's success to them, you know? So hats off to them, that's success. In my eyes though, I want to be a billionaire. So that's success to me.
That particular figure is something that you're chasing?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it a feeling that will happen when you hit that or is it the financial success that comes off the back of it? What makes that figure the one that you aim at?
A bit of everything, you know, like, no one used to hear about a millionaire before, but now everyone's a millionaire. Billionaire is like the next level. When you're a billionaire, you're like, that guy's done well.
I see this in your first.
Like, it's like the top level.
Yeah.
Like it is, you've clocked the game.
Your personality wants
my personality
to chase
wants
things
that,
down.
Yep.
I see that. And I think it's important you recognize that and recognize that not many people are wired as strongly as that.
Yeah.
Amazing, Joseph. Yeah. I've loved today's chat. Hope you have as well.
Me too. I've really enjoyed it.
If people want to continue the conversation with you, where should they head towards?
Any social media platform, just search my name.
Beautiful. Joseph Rakic. I'll link a couple of them in the show notes.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Stuff.
Thank you, Joseph. And thank you to you, the listener. I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.
Thank you for having me.